Don't forget, you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. And all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. That's you. If you'd like to become a member, because that's not you, my gosh, become a member now. Go to KBOO.FM or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for a live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tune in to KBOO on June 22nd and 23rd for our live broadcast for Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival. We'll start the broadcast from King School Park and Good in the Hood Saturday at 2 p.m. Bands include the Elliott Young Band, Hot Tea Cold, Ronnie Wright, Cool Breeze, and more. Sunday, we'll start the broadcast at noon and we'll feature Funky Fusion featuring Amanda Ryan, the Norman Sylvester Band, Soul Vaccination, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, a multicultural music, arts, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity in the community. The broadcast will be Saturday, June 22nd from 2 to 10 p.m. and Sunday, June 23rd from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. That's 90.7 in Portland, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany area, 91.9 in Hood River, and via the World Wide Web, it's KBOO.FM. And this is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott. Celeste is not with us this morning, and she is so disappointed because she wanted to talk to these two gentlemen and participate in our conversation. But maybe if she's well enough, she'll call in and share something. But in the meantime, I want to invite you to pick up this volume for maybe a summer read. It's really exciting. It's called, and I'll get it right now because I'm reading it, Aloha Rodeo. Three Hawaiian cowboys, the world's greatest rodeo, and a hidden history of the American West. And the authors, David Wallman and Julian Smith, are with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great. And you just arrived from Hawaii early this morning or last night?
Last night. Okay. This is, we're in the middle of the book tour right now.
Yes.
So it was an important week to spend some time down in Hawaii and talk to people about the book down there and share some of the stories we'd unearthed and maybe hear some additional anecdotes that we can, put in a next edition or bring up at future events. But yeah, it was a treat to be down there for this.
Great. And you, part of it, I guess, when you write a book together, you divide up the tours. You were in Central Oregon?
Yeah, I just got back from a couple readings down in Bend.
Well, great. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And maybe we would begin by sharing a little bit about how you became interested in this. For most of you have no idea what we're talking about, Aloha Rodeo. It's a book about, the Wyoming and cowboys. Okay, I'm kind of familiar with that. Okay, Aloha, these Hawaiian cowboys also participated in this in the early 20th century. Okay, enough for me. How did you become interested in this, and where did you discover this story?
So the project really began for me on a visit to Hawaii a number of years ago. There's a town on the island of Hawaii called Waimea, and they have this wonderful small heritage center, mini museum dedicated to the history of ranching and cowboys in the islands. And on a visit there, I was reading about this year, 1908, when three Hawaiian cowboys traveled all the way to Wyoming to compete in what at the time was the biggest and greatest rodeo in the world. And they came in first, third, and sixth place. And when they, we can get into the story a little bit later. So I saw this little nugget, really, but I couldn't find anything more than three or four sentences about this episode anywhere that I looked. And I just had all these questions right away. You know, I didn't know anything about ranching traditions and history in the islands, and I wondered who these guys were, what was it like for them to travel all the way to the Front Range of the Rockies at that time, and how were they received when they got there, and what happened after the contest when they got home. And so these questions were just kind of nagging at me. And as a writer, you know, that's a good sign that maybe you found something that you may or may not prove to be a great story, but it sort of has its hooks in you in a way, like you want to start dating the topic at least and see what comes of it. And so that is where it began. Julian and I both live here in Portland and had collaborated on a previous project a few years earlier, a long magazine article, and we worked well together. And so we started talking some more about this project and kicking over some more stones as far as research goes. And that's when we kind of came to this idea that we would sort of tell two stories in tandem. Yes. The emergence of Cheyenne, the rise and sudden fall of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the birth of this crazy spectacle called Cheyenne Frontier Days. And then at the same time, the story of ranching and cowboys in the islands. And then we would sort of lead the reader to this year, this moment in 1908 when these worlds collide.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so once we decided to collaborate on this, we were, you know, like Dave was saying, we were really happy to discover that the story itself pretty neatly divides into the Hawaii part and the Wyoming part. Yes. And I've personally always been a real history buff of the American West and the, you know, the cowboy history and the Native American and all that. So we decided, at least early on, to split up the first draft roughly between Dave taking the Hawaii part and I was diving into the Cheyenne part. But by about draft 7 or 8, going back and forth, you know, there is probably not a sentence in the whole book that either of us can say, you know, that's mine.
Right.
It was really smooth collaboration.
Well, that's good. So there isn't
it's a relief. Yeah.
There's no divorce afterwards now.
No, we're still friends.
And you know, the book is very new. You know, it was released 3 weeks ago or so. Mm-hmm. But it's wonderful to hear from readers already saying, like, wow, you know, I was reading it with an eye toward this question of co-authorship and does it have this sort of staccato thing to it. And people are using the word seamless right now, which is such a compliment, you know, and it is true that there's so much back and forth by the end that it doesn't really, it makes sense now that people can't decipher really strongly distinct. Voice or tone or style or what have you.
Yes, excellent. And we're speaking this morning with David Wollman and Julian Smith, authors of Aloha Rodeo, Three Hawaiian Cowboys, the World's Greatest Rodeo, and A Hidden History of the American West, recently published, and it's an exciting volume. So, Julian, with your background in the American West, were you familiar with Hawaiian?
Not at all, really. That was, to me, that was one of the most interesting parts of working on this story, because I think maybe once I had heard that there were cowboys or the cowboy equivalent in Hawaii, but I knew nothing at all about it. And, you know, yeah, as a nonfiction writer, when you feel a whole new topic open up in front of you, it's really exciting. And mm-hmm. so that was completely new to me. And even the stuff in the West, some of the things I'd heard of, you know, Buffalo Bill's Wild West Show, mm-hmm. Annie Oakley, Theodore Roosevelt's involvement, but really being able to weave those together into one narrative and bring in all this Hawaii stuff, it was really a challenge, but it was also really fun to do and fun to research.
And I think that's a good way of describing what you do in this book, weaving it together, because certainly we've heard these people, you know, Roosevelt, Buffalo Bill, Bill Pickett, and just the mystery and the part of the Americana love affair with cowboys and the American West, and somehow you're able to bring together all these stories together, which make it very good.
Well, thank you.
Great. So, tell us. You mentioned 1908 and Cheyenne. Some who might be familiar with Hawaii know like 1898. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, the overthrow of the monarchy and the descendants of the missionaries who were able to take over the kingdom. Unfamiliar with what happened. Well, unfamiliar to many of us is the trauma that the people experienced, which you write about, and how perhaps, you know, within 10 years, these people come to Wyoming and participate in what we think is the most typical part of Americana. Tell us something about how did cattle get to Hawaii?
All of it, huh?
and then how did they, these cowboy Pañola, get to Wyoming?
Sure. Well, in the very final years of the 1700s, Captain George Vancouver arrives at the island of Hawaii carrying a few Spanish longhorns as a gift for the king. They're trying to reestablish relations with the so-called Sandwich Islands at that time, after Captain James Cook's fateful visit to the islands about 20 years earlier. And one of the animals doesn't even live to see its first sunset on the beaches after this arduous journey across the ocean. But just enough cattle survive this first trip that they're able to reproduce in the islands. And what's important in that moment is the king puts a taboo on anyone touching or harming these animals. And within a matter of 20 or 30 years or so, Hawaii has essentially an ecological emergency on its hands, because there are now thousands and thousands of feral cattle running roughshod over the islands, trampling garden plots, goring people. These are not docile dairy cows. You know, these are wild animals with 5-6 foot racks, deadly. And what happens is that the king had gotten wind of what the Spanish vaqueros, the cowboys on the west coast of North America, at that time sort of Spanish California, they got wind of the fact that there are these ranches up there where they're managing the cattle, not just where the animals exist, but there's an element of controlling them, where they are, and their numbers. And so the Hawaiian, the monarchy sends for some help, basically, and some mentors, some Spanish vaqueros come to the islands to teach the Hawaiians how to rope and manage cattle. And, you know, going back to your earlier point for a moment about some of these disparate characters from Buffalo Bill Cody, Annie Oakley, Bill Pickett, the vaqueros, you know, one of the things that, one of the themes that really underscores this whole book is sort of rethinking what we think we know about the American West. Mm-hmm. What is its far extent to the West? And what does a cowboy look like? And who were the first cowboys? And, you know, so much of our kind of reflexive thinking on this subject is shaped by John Wayne movies or the Marlboro Man. And the vaqueros are such an important piece of this story because they are a reminder of who the first actual cowboys on this continent were. They looked nothing like the Marlboro Man. And anyway, the vaqueros get to Hawaii. They teach the Hawaiians how to do this thing. They get so good at it so quickly that the vaqueros essentially put themselves out of a job. Mm-hmm. And this is the birth of the ranching and cowboy traditions in the islands. So I'll pause there for a moment before we kind of get to Cheyenne in 1907, 1908, but maybe Julian wants to jump in with something.
Yeah, I would just add that that's where we get the term paniolo, which is the Hawaiian term for cowboy, which is actually a slightly Hawaiianized version of the word espanol for Spanish, which is where they learned this stuff from.
Amazing, amazing. We're speaking this morning with David Waldman and Julian Smith of authors of Aloha Rodeo. Give us a call to participate. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Okay. Thank you, Jenny. I just had a brain freeze for a second. Okay. To talk and participate in our conversation. So, you know, you have all these cattle running around in Hawaii, taught how to round them up, or I don't know the right words. And,
wrangle.
Okay, thank you. How did then this ability to live with the cattle in Hawaii, and how did what was the connection to the Wyoming? How did that take place?
Well, this around the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, was a time of real significant change everywhere, of course, but especially in the American West, where it was kind of the end of the classic cowboy decades, you know, 1860, 1870, 1880. Which is where we get most of those classic images of, you know, the cowboy on the open range. But, you know, with the invention of barbed wire and the increasing settlement out west, those days were pretty clearly coming to an end. And that's where Cheyenne comes in, because it was one of the hugest, one of the largest boom towns of the whole cattle drive era. You know, at one point, it was supposedly the richest city of its size in the country. You know, they had an opera house, they had electricity before most other places. But then when the market collapsed, Cheyenne's economy just tanked. And so the city fathers were looking around saying, what can we do to replace this as a source of income so our town doesn't just dry up and blow away? And that was the time when the sport of rodeo was really taking off throughout the West. You know, cowboys, wherever they are, have always participated in, you know, games and challenges when they're sitting around. They're, you know, throwing a lasso, seeing who can break a bronco better than anybody else. But that was actually starting to be formalized in these contests. And it was happening throughout the West. Even in Hawaii, some of these contests started to trickle in the first decade of the 20th century. So Cheyenne's frontier days turned out to be one of the biggest successes. It was kind of a combination of rodeo and cultural celebration of this Western culture that the people there they were really proud of, but they could also see was in danger of being lost. It was fading. And so they wanted to in a really interesting way, kind of consciously preserve this culture. And, you know, obviously they're pretty darn successful because the image of the cowboy is one of the most enduring images probably worldwide now. So you have a combination of the rise of Frontier Days as one of the biggest rodeos in the country, mm-hmm. and these small rodeos in Honolulu. And eventually we have a character called Eben Lowe, who was a one-handed cowboy, one-handed Paniolo. He lost his hand in this crazy accident up in the jungle. But he was a really talented Paniolo, but he was also a real, you know, entrepreneur. He was always looking for the next thing, you know, mm-hmm. you got to make a living. So he, first of all, he knew all the best Paniolo in Hawaii because it wasn't a very big world. And he also traveled around the United States on the mainland. And he made a trip in 1907 where he was traveling around the country. You know, he stopped by the White House, said hi to Teddy Roosevelt, as you could apparently do in those days. And he ended up in Cheyenne watching Frontier Days and basically sitting on the fence, looking at the talent there, saying, yeah, these mainland cowboys, they're pretty good. You know, they're coming from Wyoming, they're coming from Colorado, Texas, Arizona. But at the same time thinking, you know, my cousins back home can beat these guys. So maybe this is a little showdown we should try to set up.
Okay. So before that August 1907 contest is concluded, Eben Lowe has already invited some Wyoming cowboys to come to Honolulu to compete in a rodeo he was organizing for December. Right. And some of them do come. One of them actually left during a fierce winter storm in Wyoming and got to Honolulu, looked around at the scenery and the mild climate and never left. Mm-hmm. and at the same time, he was also putting the pieces in place for his cousins to attend and compete in the steer roping competition for 1908. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of the climax of our story, is what happens in that year. Our three heroes, Ikua, Jack, and Archie, you know, their journey is about 4,000 miles. They'd never left the islands. They get to San Francisco on a steamship just a couple of years after the great earthquake, you know, and so we're trying to imagine what this must have been like for them. They take a ferry across the bay and they hop the overland train, which they ride over the Sierras and the Rockies, and then landing at the Front Range in Cheyenne. And, you know, we did the best we could digging up some archival material about what how they were received by the community mm-hmm. in Wyoming. And, you know, the two points I'll add to that idea is, without sort of giving away everything in the book, but on the one hand, I think Wyoming and Cheyenne residents were kind of proud of the fact that these people were traveling so far away to compete in their big show.
Yes.
You know, what better validation that our rodeo is indeed the greatest rodeo in the world if people are going to travel so far away.
Right.
You know, a lot of people at that time couldn't even locate Hawaii on a map, let alone know that it about the forced annexation just a little bit more than a decade prior. So in some cases, they're talking about the Hawaiians as quote-unquote foreigners. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of sort of bigoted language, like in the newspaper coverage about the brown Kanakas, for example. But there wasn't at first this sense that, any sense really, that these were actual cowboys, capable athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost more like this circus act.
Yes.
And then after day one of the competition, you see this dramatic shift in the newspaper coverage, you know, mm-hmm. that we were certainly savoring, I think, as we were reading through this stuff, because the Paniolo, the Hawaiian cowboys, were fantastic ropers. And so that's when any spirit of welcoming from the newspaper reporters in Cheyenne
yeah.
shifted quickly to, like, okay, Wyoming native sons, like, let's send these guys packing.
Yes.
And, of course, that's not how it played out.
Right. So what, for Ikua, Jack, and Archie, what is your sense from reading and researching? Why did they want to participate, or felt the need to participate in the rodeo? Was it for validation? Was it for, I don't know, something else or pure competition?
Yeah, that's when we were doing the research, that was one of the questions we had in mind. And we quickly found that these three guys were, in a lot of ways, the classic cowboys, in that they were supremely talented, very independent, and kind of taciturn, you know, men of few words. So when they went to Hawaii, I mean, when they went to Cheyenne, they were, as far as we can gather from what we researched, they were doing it to show what they could do. Really, they were proud of their abilities, and their cousin Eben, the entrepreneur, really set this up. And he said, "You guys want to go?" And they said, "Absolutely. You know, we'll show." You know, we'll show these mainlanders what we can do. Mm-hmm. You know, and you got to imagine that there was an element of that, of kind of responding to annexation, because that was a really culturally traumatic time in Hawaii. And so now you have an invitation to compete against this country that basically just took over your country, absorbed your country. And so there's also definitely a sense of adventure there. They'd never been beyond the islands, and they're traveling across the biggest ocean in the world and halfway across a continent. But beyond that, it was one of the elements that we were also really focusing on was how it even went beyond their own personal motivations and feelings, because they kind of became these unlikely ambassadors, yes, almost, of Hawaii in the heartland of America, literally and figuratively. And so they carried a lot on their shoulders symbolically. Mm-hmm. You know, they were bearing the flag, you know, you could almost say, of Hawaii into the middle of America. And even though Hawaii was technically part of America, so they were in it for the adventure, they were in it for the challenge, and as it turned out, they were in it almost for the good of the islands overall.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I'm speaking with David Wollman and Julian Smith, authors of Aloha Rodeo, Three Hawaiian Cowboys, The World's Greatest Rodeo, and A Hidden History of the American West. If you would like to speak with them, our numbers are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have any questions about this book, about the topic. Let them know. We will have the opportunity. I think Julian's going to read a portion of the book later, or is it David? Or okay.
We'll arm wrestle for it.
Yeah, okay. Seamless couple. We won't...
Rock, paper, scissors.
We'll figure it out. But please, if you like, give us a call, and try not to wait till the end of the show when everyone's trying to call at the same time. Speaking about the cultural emphasis and the differences between... what was happening in Cheyenne, what was happening in Hawaii. You mentioned, I think, David, you mentioned in terms of the initial coverage of these gentlemen who came, and it was sort of like, oh, maybe this is really good. We're on the world stage now. All the people from thousands of miles are coming. And that the coverage shifted in terms of as they understood the strength and the abilities of these cowboys, but in terms of cultural clashes, were there examples of that where all those, they were all cowboys, they're different cowboys? Could you? Were the cultural clashes? Or
sure. Yeah, what we know from the historical record, at least, you know, some of this we can surmise, but the rest of it, you know, you with a nonfiction book like this, you go to write the thing with the material you have, not the mm-hmm. material you wish you had. Yes. And so there is that sense of everyone bonding because they all work with cattle and spend mm-hmm. the days on end in the saddle of a horse. doing the same craft, but the Hawaiians looked different, not just because they had darker skin, but their gear was slightly different. Yeah. It had sort of evolved in different ways in terms of the ornamentation on their chaps, and their lariats were different, and they wore wildflowers around the brim of their cowboy hats. So, you know, I would say at best it was puzzled looks at these guys, but there's certainly... was a degree of discrimination and racism expressed toward them. We know of one episode when someone tried to kick them out of a saloon. We also know that they did not get horses to practice with until very close until the competition, which is quite unfair because in steer roping, the close working relationship between rider and horse is essential for rodeo sport reasons we can get into some other day, but it's essential. The legend in the islands is that actually they had been given terrible horses to compete with. And we did not find evidence to support that view, and in fact found evidence to the contrary. And you can look at some photos from that era, and if you know a lot about horses, it's clear that these were strong, capable animals. But the fact that the Hawaiians couldn't practice until right up until competition day was really put them at a disadvantage. But the reality for our heroes in this story is that this was kind of a walk in the park compared to everyday work of being a paniolo in the islands. I mean, just to set the scene for a moment, they are hunting for and chasing down cattle at an elevation of 6,000-7,000 feet on the volcano of Mauna Kea. It first in dense forests, in heavy rain and cold. Then they are herding the cattle down the slopes of the volcano across scorching hot lava flows. Then they get down to the beach where they have to herd the animals into the surf, which we can talk more about because it's stunning. So for these virtuosos, really, of the range, to go and compete in this, like, even grassy or dirt rodeo ring, you know, for leisure was just not that big of a deal. And so I'm sure while they are pretty stunned to be in this new environment of the continental American West, seeing the Rocky Mountains, for example, or this ocean of grass in Wyoming, and different culture and different people, you know, that it must have been stunning for them. But on the other hand, you know, they certainly weren't facing the hazards that they faced every day just chasing cattle in Hawaii, you know, where one, you could be looking one way and all of a sudden your horse is plunging into a collapsed lava tube. It's pretty wonderful to imagine what it was like for these guys to get to Wyoming and be like, yeah, okay, we can do this too.
We can do that, yeah. You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with David Wolman and Julian Smith, authors of Aloha Rodeo and their arm wrestling for Who Will Read. But in the meantime, let me remind you, our numbers are 503-231-8187. And we have a caller, so let's talk to Mike. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Cecil. I've got three questions. Maybe I could take the answer off the air. But number one, did they bring their own gear with them when they came? And number two, were they able to ride their own ponies, or did they have to use ponies that were there at Cheyenne? And number three, was the American penchant for whiskey and alcohol a factor in any of it? Because I doubt very much if those Hawaiian cowboys drank heavily like, you know, the early Americans.
Hey, great. Okay.
Those are my three questions.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike.
Great. Well,
okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, like we were saying, they did not bring their own horses. It would have been an incredible journey just for them, let alone bringing their mounts. Their gear, they did bring their own gear. And that was one of the things people noticed when they showed up, was how slightly different their gear was. You know, they had many of the same accoutrements as the cowboys in Wyoming. You know, they had chaps, they had hats, spurs, but there are also subtle differences. Like their spurs are a little bit smaller, so they wouldn't get caught in all the vegetation in the jungle. Mm-hmm. Their hat brims were wider because, you know, there's a lot of sun and rain in Hawaii. And the biggest difference to everybody there, at least the cowboys, was that their lassos, their lariats, were not made out of the woven manila fiber like most of the cowboys used on the mainland, but they were braided rawhide. And that they chose that because that's what lasted the best in the humid conditions in Hawaii. Otherwise, their ropes would have just rotted away. In terms of alcohol, yes, these guys were definitely known to take a drink now and then. Gin seemed to be their tot of choice, you know, staying warm up in the dripping cold jungles on the islands. There's that anecdote about them walking into a saloon in Cheyenne and the bartender saying, "Oh, no, you guys, get out of here." But once somebody told the bartender who they were, that all changed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. What's the name of that book again?
It's called Aloha Rodeo.
Aloha Rodeo. All right. Well, I'm going to have to get me a copy.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Please do. It's a great read.
Thank you, guys. This is excellent.
Thank you.
And you are listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with David Wollman and Julian Smith, authors of Aloha Rodeo, talking about Hawaiian cowboys in Cheyenne, Wyoming, in 1908. And, our numbers are 503-231-8187 if you have a question or comment. And let's see if we can get a sense of your writing and what you have for us.
Okay. I'll just do something extra short here, but we were talking a moment ago about the work of the Paniolo. And one thing that really distinguishes cowboy tradition and practice in the islands is that at the time they had to herd the animals into the surf because to load them onto the steamships bound for the slaughterhouse in Honolulu or for markets abroad, there were no loading docks on the shore at the time. So the giant steamships have to park out past the reef. And so the Paniolo, the Hawaiian cowboy, one at a time, they would herd the animals into the surf and swim them out to a longboat, which had one or two men with oars. And they would get about six or eight animals tied to the gunwale of these boats that would then row out to the big steamships, hoist them up on deck. I mean, it was incredibly dramatic work. And at one time, one of our protagonists, Eben Lowe, was giving a presentation in Texas during his mainland tour about the work that they do and had some pictures even. And one of the Texas newspapers the next morning was sort of summarizing his visit and said, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something to the tune of, wow, we thought Texas cowboys were tough, but these guys really take the cake or raise it to the next level or something like that. Anyway, so this is a very short excerpt about that work and what they faced in the waters. And then there were the sharks. The reefs that protected the harbors used for loading cattle were favorite feeding grounds for marine predators. On loading days, sharks sometimes congregated near the whaleboats, nosing for steak tartare. Sailors used rifles to scare them away, even dynamite on occasion. One May morning in 1884, Sam Parker, John Palmer Parker's grandson, was helping load cattle onto a steamship at Kauai High. The work was going well, when, in a blur of teeth and blood, a massive shark suddenly bit a swimming calf in two. This could not stand, and the men in the whaleboat gave chase. They managed to stick a harpoon in the shark, but even then it dragged the boat through the waves like a child's toy, a Hawaiian version of the Nantucket sleigh ride that New England whalers described after harpooning a humpback. Finally, the exhausted shark relented. Parker and the cowboys used their lassos to haul the monster to shore and onto the beach. A quick measurement showed it was 18 feet long and almost 6 feet around. Parker cut off its head to keep as a souvenir. I'll stop there.
Yeah. It's just like, wow, amazing. So, I mean, that's just a small glimpse of a description of what people experience. But also, I think what the listeners could hear was a sense in terms of your writing, and how you invite people in. So it's more than a narrative. It's participation in the story. So I appreciate that. Our numbers again, 503-231-8187. And let's go to our next caller. Scott, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Cecil. It's a great show this morning. I wanted to ask the authors kind of a sidebar question. In the southeast corner of Oregon, there's the Owyhee country, great canyon lands, also into Idaho. And I was wondering if the authors in their researches learned anything about that area. I think the name geographically came from Hawaiians who may have originally been some of the people who explored the area. And I wonder if they learned anything about that and they could talk about that.
Yeah, that was one of the Oregon connections we were able to make in the book. The Owyhee River and Owyhee Canyonlands, that word does come from the word Hawaii, and it was named after three Hawaiian herders / explorers who went out to explore that country, which, if you've been there, it's pretty close to Utah in terms of what it looks like, with these big, dry, deep canyons. And so they never returned. So nobody ever knows what happened to them. But at least they got a river named after them. And the other Oregon connection was in the Bronco bucking competition in 1908 Frontier Days. It was this epic showdown between two of the best Bronco buckers and a legendary horse named Steamboat, which is one of these many side stories we came across writing the book that could basically make a whole other book in itself. So one of these two champion Bronco busters came from Portland. He hopped on a train. He was working in a Wild West show, actually, here in Portland. And he hopped on a train to go to Frontier Days, barely made it in time, literally just hours before he had to go out, and ended up in this truly just cinematic showdown with another guy and this horse who had never been ridden with spurs to a standstill. And as it turned out, this guy who came from Portland, he was Dick Stanley, but he actually wasn't Dick Stanley. He was known by another name, and he was actually wanted for murder, as it turned out.
Scott, hello, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. I was just
okay.
Very interested by the tale. Yeah,
right.
Thanks very much. It was very interesting.
Thanks for calling.
I look forward to reading the book.
Thank you so much. As we talk about the stories and the lives of the people involved here, many times we are caught up, or people are caught up in the immediacy. So we open up a book and we are excited about the story, and then we close the book and we move on. In a way, what happens, share something about what happened to the people and the places following this initial meeting of the Hawaiian cowboys with those involved in the rodeo in Wyoming. When they return to Hawaii, what do they say to the people, their family and their friends, about their experience?
Yeah, when the Hawaiians returned to the islands, of course, because of newspapers, everyone knew what had happened. The coverage on the mainland even had reached as far east as Rochester, New York, where they're reporting about these quote-unquote foreigners stealing the championship. When the Paniolo returned to Honolulu first, they're greeted at the docks by thousands of people, waving flags. There's music. There's been hula that has been composed in their honor, and poetry written to celebrate their victory. And there's basically party after party after party. They're island hopping to the next luau, and great speeches and toasts. And they are really, as Julian had mentioned earlier, were sort of these accidental ambassadors mm-hmm. of Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian pride at the time. And it wasn't necessarily in their personality to be in the spotlight like that, especially right. Ikua. You know, interestingly, Eben Lowe, the one-handed roper, impresario, showman character, it really was in his personality, but he didn't go to Wyoming. He had made it all happen for them. Right. But when they came back, he made sure to let everyone know that he had made arrangements for this whole thing, and that these were his cousins, and right. he had called it. He knew. He was the one sitting in the stands in 1907 watching those Wyoming cowboys, thinking, my cousins could take these guys. And, you know, his later in life recollections about what happened are so vivid. He kind of misleads a lot of people, including people writing this history, into thinking that he was there. And mm-hmm. I don't think this is capital L lying. I think it's like someone later in life really sort of living vicariously through his cousins had heard the story so much from them that in the retelling it just kind of came out that as if I was there in the stands. Mm-hmm. And in some ways he might as well have been. But so anyway, the Hawaiians are treated as heroes, welcomed home as heroes. One interesting coda to the story that I love about Ikua Purdy is that he took the saddle that he won as a prize mm-hmm. and essentially he just shoved it under the porch of his little mountain cabin where he lived and never went back to the mainland to compete, and he just got back to doing the work that he really loved, which was roping cattle up on the mountain. And there's just something kind of poetic about that it was never about, certainly wasn't about the limelight or prize money or even sport. You know, I think these guys enjoyed it. They participated in rodeo in the islands afterwards, but it was more almost as a judge and things like that. But there's this kind of been there, done that shrug to Ikua Purdy's reaction to the whole thing that I like thinking about him in that moment, shoving the saddle prize under the porch and be like, okay, let's go back to roping cattle in the moonlight.
Exactly. So, you know, it wasn't as if they were living today, that would have been Instagram and social media, and they would have been Toast of Hollywood or anything necessarily.
No, back then it was newspapers and word of mouth.
Yeah.
That's what you had.
So say a little bit more in terms of the publicity from the rodeo throughout the United States. Certainly, there was certainly a fascination with the American West and with the lifestyle. And so generations of girls and boys grew up reading about the American West and wanting to be a cowboy. Was it possible for other lessons to be learned from this story in terms of how widespread the Western culture was, and possibly about the way in which people are able to bridge differences, whether it's over thousands of miles of oceans or not.
That was definitely one of our favorite themes going through the book, is, you know, not just this meeting of these very similar but also distinctly different cultures, and like we were talking about before, the kind of mythologizing of the American West, going the transition from reality to myth. and kind of the intentional transition.
Yes.
You know, and nobody was more responsible that probably than Buffalo Bill Cody,
yes,
who had this traveling show of hundreds of people and animals, including, you know, live buffalo and entire families of Native Americans, reenacting these battles, these famous battles that had just happened 20, 30 years before, sometimes with people who had actually participated in the battle. And he took this show all around the country, took it as far away as Europe, was performing for kings and queens. And at its peak, he was arguably the most famous person on the planet. He was the first like real international superstar. And his whole thing was promoting this version of the American West, which, you know, you have to be honest, and it's one version of the American West. It's basically the white man's version of the American West, with Native Americans kind of playing a side role. But the more you dig into the actual history, the more you find how diverse it really was, surprisingly, on the frontier. You know, just starting with African-American cowboys, you know, by some estimates, one in four cowboys on the American West were black, including some of the most famous, best cowboys, including, you know, Bill Pickett, who you mentioned before. He was famous for his performance of taking down a full-grown steer just using his teeth. He did that at Frontier Days in 1904, to the just absolute amazement of the crowd. You know, there are characters like Bass Reeves, who was a legendary Texas Ranger, who brought in thousands of criminals, including his own son at one point. He was one of the inspirations for the Lone Ranger. And speaking of the 1904 Frontier Days, there was also a memorable performance there by a woman named Bertha Pickett. Bertha Kopernik was her name at the time. And she traveled all the way from Colorado to take them up on the offer. That was the first year that the festival organizers said women can compete in bronco busting. They didn't really expect any to show up. They were just kind of doing it for appearances. But she showed up. And when the male bronco riders refused to come out one day because it had just rained and the field was muddy, and they said, it's just too dangerous, Bertha stepped forward and hopped on her horse that she had brought, named Tombstone, and gave this performance that just put all the male cowboys to shame. And so it was stories like that that really kind of fleshed out the history of the West for us, and shows that it's much more complex, and it's much more interesting than this kind of John Wayne Lonesome Dove version, which, you know, in itself it's a good story, it's entertaining, but it's far from the truth.
And we'll go to our next caller.
Actually, this is Jenna Bordoff. Jenna, we had a question from a caller who didn't want to have to go on air, but wanted to ask our authors, how much time did the authors live and spend with the Pañuelos in Hawaii while they were researching for this book?
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think in total there were four trips down there. Some of the time was not so much with human beings, but much more in a windowless basement room in the archives. Yeah. We were at the State Archives. We were at the Bishop Museum. There was a research center on the island of Hawaii in the town called Honoka'a that we spent some time at. So we were doing the work. And then in addition, there were some wonderful and welcoming people in Hawaii who were very supportive of the project. So some scholars from the University of Hawaii and some retired and still working Pañuelo, especially at the Parker Ranch on the Big Island, which is kind of the epicenter of this whole story. And Julian and I even took a trip with some of the retired cowboys up over Mauna Kea. It's not technically up and over the summit where all of the observatories are, but we spent a couple of days staying at this cabin that used to be one of the cowboy stations up on the mountain, because the work could be so remote sometimes that they would spend the night in these little, very rustic cabins instead of coming all the way back down to town. So we spent a couple nights up there exploring a lot of the old sites where the cowboys were doing the work, and listening to these retired Paniolo, as well as some local conservation and ecology experts, teach us about the landscape, really. Mm-hmm. And, it was really memorable and valuable reporting trip for us to be up there. And, you know, since then, actually, and since the book has even come out, we've been connecting with some other cowboys, and some of the descendants of the protagonists in the story have been reaching out to us. And so far, everyone is really happy with not just with the product, but as one great grandson of Archie Kaawa, one of our heroes, you know, he just said, thank you so much for doing the work. I had only ever heard this story growing up, you know, so many times, but just in really broad strokes, that's all we ever really got. And so that was, you know, that was great to hear that kind of reaction.
From the family, excellent. So, where do we go? You two have collaborated before. You aren't pointing pistols at one another, so there's a possibility you might collaborate in the future.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there isn't a project at the moment that is like, again, as we had said earlier, you know, you need to make sure that this is something you can sink your teeth into and and isn't just a quick hit front of the book magazine idea. So you have to wait till you have like the right thing that you really want to spend a lot of time with, and then also see if it's something that suits itself for collaboration, because as we were saying early on, you know, this one had that interesting and I think kind of rare natural division of labor to it, that like, okay, Julian's going to tackle some of the Wyoming stuff at first, I'll do the Hawaii stuff, and then we will braid this material together and
educate each other.
And you know, the next story out there about who knows what, it just might not lend itself to that strategy. But you don't know, and you know, in the meantime, it has been such a delight to be in a story that, as Julian was saying earlier, really just upsets our conventional, simplistic, and rather incorrect thinking about what the West was and what it looked like and who was a cowboy. And you know, the fact that these Ikua Purdy wasn't inducted into the Rodeo Hall of Fame until 1999. Yeah. You know, so the white people who wrote history for almost, what was that, 90 years or so, 89 years, decided that this guy wasn't worthy. And so, you know, it's not just that that kind of story should be written. It's that when you go searching for those more inclusive stories, you find great ones.
Yes.
You know, it's not just like sort of a do-gooder thing. It's like, oh my gosh, this is an amazing yarn. Let's go chase after it.
And that it is. I want to thank you both for sharing your talents and your research with us. Aloha Rodeo, Three Hawaiian Cowboys, the World's Greatest Rodeo, and a Hidden History of the American West, David Wolman and Julian Smith. You have created a book that I think many people will enjoy reading. So thank you for allowing us to learn more about something we thought we knew.
Thanks for having us.
Thank
it's been
you.
A pleasure.
So stay tuned. Please get a volume of Aloha Rodeo. I'm going to ask them to sign my copy, but I'm sure they Amazon and all your local bookstores, you can get them. You've been listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for the Omo Variety Hour. At 10 is Locus Focus. At 11, First Voices Radio. And don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.FM or on iTunes and Google Play. Have a great day. Thank you.
Meet me on the mountain.
KBOO wants you to meet us where the music's at.
You can see awesome live bands like Fruition.
That's right. KBOO wants to send you to a concert this summer.
Just enter the KBOO Summer Music Raffle, where three lucky winners will choose in order from three awesome events.
You could win 2 3-day passes to the Northwest String Summit, July 19th to the 21st.
A pair of Sunday tickets to Pickathon, August 4th.
A pair of tickets to Lord Huron and Shaky Graves at the Oregon Zoo, August 12th.
Tickets are just $5, and if you buy 4, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summermusicraffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Four Peaks Music Festival, June 20th through 23rd at Stevenson Ranch in Bend, Oregon. Four Peaks Music Festival is a 4-day music event featuring an eclectic array of national, regional, and local bands. Performers include Poor Man's Whiskey, Los Lobos, Sister Sparrow, The Drunken Hearts, and many more. There will also be food, craft vendors, a kid zone, and more. Again, that's the Four Peaks Music Festival, June 20th through 23rd at Stevenson Ranch, 21085 Knott Road in Bend, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.